We are here for our third oral argument case for oral argument this morning, which is A24-1470, State of Minnesota versus James Michaels, or respondent versus James Michael Peters, the third appellant. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. If you would please state your name and the party you represent for the record at the start of your argument, we'd appreciate it. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case is being presented on Zoom Gov, and an oral, or excuse me, an audio version only will be maintained on our public website thereafter. If you could keep your mute on when you're not speaking, that would be appreciated. And other than that, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, James Peters III. I'm happy to take any questions from the court on any of the issues raised in our brief. I'd like to start with the suppression issue. The state chose to litigate this case with a single argument, one the prosecutor said was, quote, near and dear to my heart. That was the idea that Mr. Peters lacked standing to contest the constitutionality of his own seizure. The state at the omnibus hearing chose not to present any other evidence and in fact refused an invitation from the district court judge to do so. The district court's decision that Mr. Peters does not have standing to challenge the constitutionality of his own seizure is wrong. It is directly contrary to, among other things, Brendelin versus California. And this court should reverse and should reverse Mr. Peters' conviction without giving the state a second opportunity to try to meet its burden.
Why wouldn't we give the court the opportunity to address, if the court was wrong and addressed this under a standing framework, if that's wrong, why does the court not get a chance then to determine if this evidence should be suppressed? I'm not saying give them another bite at the apple, but just a remand for us to consider or find out what the court was thinking.
Well, I mean, we know, Your Honor, what the district court was thinking. It wrote an order and adopted, actually affirmatively adopted the 40-page memo written by Mr. Bueller as its legal rationale for denying this motion to suppress. So we know what the district court was thinking. Your position that the court could have another chance would make sense if, for example, as what happens sometimes, the state argues two theories to deny a motion, the district court adopts one and doesn't address the second one. That would make sense for a remand. The state here did not argue two theories. It argued one theory only. And that was the theory that was near and dear to the prosecutor's heart. And that is this idea that Mr. Peters somehow did not have standing to contest the constitutionality of his own seizure. At page 26 of the transcript of the October 9th, 2023 hearing, the district court judge asked the prosecutor, do you want to advance the testimony of the officer today? Meaning the officer who stopped Mr. Peters. And the prosecutor emphatically said no, and said something along the line, I don't have a quote, but it's something like, I don't have an obligation to justify anything because Mr. Peters doesn't have standing.
I understand, of course, your argument, Mr. Butler. I'm just wondering whether, I mean, here's how I read the hearings. You know, there was a challenge to the seizure for a lack of reasonable articulable suspicion. They go to the, and I assume that the appellant expected the officer to come testify to the stop. They go to the first hearing, and I believe the officer, it seems implied anyway, the officer is there. And then the state says, we don't have to put on anything until, unless standing's proved. And I think even at some point, maybe in that hearing or the next one says, until the district court has ruled even, I think it's represented. But, and I understand the argument that the state then, you know, didn't put on its, you know, shouldn't get to put on its witnesses now. But when I look at the second, I think that the defense counsel was caught unawares at the first hearing. And when I look at the second hearing, when the other witness came, I mean, defense counsel talks about, we're still dealing, I'm quoting, with the preliminary issue the state raised at the last hearing. So I don't know that we're going to conclude the omnibus issues today. And defense counsel says, I think we're just trying to establish and get past that part of the hearing here today. And then the state says, you know, we would actually go forward with a full contested hearing if the defendant, you know, meets his burden. The court says, okay, thank you both for clarifying that. And then it strikes me that one could read that as the district court thinking the parties agreed that they were dealing just with the threat, what the state identified as a threshold issue. So, apropos of whether the district court should get an opportunity to actually hear the evidence on this, is, you know, in that context, wouldn't that seem fair if we agreed with you on the first question?
No, Your Honor, for a couple reasons. First of all, I think I heard you use the word agreement or agree that the defense counsel agreed to this. That is not true. This was sprung on the defense
I mean,
counsel by
agreed
the
on that second part when they were both discussing that they weren't going to finish it, that that day was about the pro, quote, so-called preliminary threshold
I
question.
think by that point, Your Honor, everyone is just acquiescing to Mr. Bueller's contention of how this should go. And again, how this should go, according to the state and the way the district court did it, is contrary to every Minnesota Supreme Court case on how suppression hearings in this state are litigated since 1965. Since 1965, in State versus Rasmussen, the Supreme Court laid out how these hearings go and said the state bears the burden of proving that the evidence was lawfully obtained. And in the 1970s, the Minnesota or the United States Supreme Court said these quote unquote standing issues are not threshold issues. They are part and parcel of the Fourth Amendment issue, whether the Fourth Amendment was violated. Rasmussen also says the state has to go first at the suppression hearing. The state in this case blew right through all of that. And yes, the defense attorney kind of went along with it. And the district court should have been the one to say, hang on, that's not how we do this. That's not how the cases say we do it. In addition, if there was any confusion about that, Needham from 1989 makes this clear because Needham says the only thing the defendant has to do at a suppression hearing is provide notice of the government conduct that is at issue. And then the state bears the burden of proving the lawfulness of that conduct. And if the state at the omnibus hearing chooses to present particular pieces of evidence to try to meet its burden, then it doesn't get a second crack at it. And this court, in numerous cases, they're cited at page 6 of our reply brief, rejected arguments exactly like this from the government in cases where the state did not present certain evidence at the omnibus hearing and asked for a remand to inflate the record to explain why a different theory might work. And this court said no. So when you
What would
don't meet
happen,
your burden.
counsel, in a case, and maybe they're
Judge
just
Smith,
going to, oh,
if I could interrupt, Mr. Bueller is not on screen, and I'm concerned that maybe he's not hearing what we're discussing.
oh
Oh,
my
there he
gosh,
is.
thank you for noticing that. Mr. Bueller, how long have you been? Can you pause? Oh, thank you. Or
I've
watch.
been on the entire time. Sorry, Your
Oh.
Honor. When you said to be off, I thought both video and audio, you wanted me off.
Oh, no, just the audio, please. Thank you. We
Sorry
want to
about
make
that.
sure that we have you still. Okay, Mr. Butler, if there was a case, a different case, where you could see that there was a live issue about whether someone was trying to vicariously raise someone else's, you know, Fourth Amendment rights, et cetera. And so there's the question of what, you know, I'll put in quotes standing, but just we'll put in whatever shorthand we want to use for that. Are you saying that it would be error for the district court? And, you know, let's say the, I don't know, the appellant or the defendant wanted to put on some evidence to show, you know, I do have an interest, a privacy expectation, and equity. Would it be error to sort of decide to bifurcate the hearing for the district court and address maybe that question without getting into whatever else might have been a problem, you know, the stop or et cetera?
I do think in Minnesota it would be, Your Honor, but if as long as by bifurcate you mean make the defendant go first, or have the defendant go first, because Rasmussen is really clear on who goes first. And I also think it matters that against quote unquote standing is not a threshold inquiry at all under the Fourth Amendment. And that's been true since Rackus versus Illinois. The question is whether the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights were violated by whatever the police did. So, take a classic standing question. The police invade an apartment in which the defendant is maybe present, but may or may not be on the lease, may or may not be a short-term social guest, whatever. May or may not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that apartment. Whether he does or he doesn't depends on, is going to determine whether his Fourth Amendment rights are violated or not by by an illegal government action. And the way that gets litigated under Rasmussen and under Needham is the defendant gives notice and says, I think this action violated my rights. And then we go to a hearing, and the state proceeds first and says, here are the police officers, here's what they did. And if the defendant has evidence to present, he presents it. And if he doesn't, he doesn't. And it is sometimes it's the defendant's burden to prove standing, prove reasonable expectation of privacy. So in a lot of cases, the defendant's going to choose to present evidence. But you could also present evidence through the government's witnesses, cross-examination, et cetera. None of that, of course, is true here. Here, we're not talking about reasonable expectation of privacy. We're talking about a seizure of the defendant. And in Brendolyn versus California at page 254, the United States Supreme Court held that a person who is seized, in that case, the passenger in a traffic stop, quote, is entitled to challenge the government's actions under the Fourth Amendment. That case is years old. And that was every single federal circuit court of appeals to have addressed the issue, according to the Brendolyn court, had said exactly that. And if you do a search in Brendolyn for the phrase reasonable expectation of privacy, you won't find it. You can do a Control F search, you won't find it. You won't find anything about whether the defendant has a privacy interest in the automobile that stopped, whether the passenger does, because that's not the issue. The issue is the defendant's personal freedom of movement has been circumvented by the police. And of course, he can challenge that. He can challenge that action. So that goes to sort of the merits of the standing question. On the issue of whether there should be a remand, this court in a recent decision, it's an unpublished one or non-precedential rather, but it's called Fohrenkamm. And at Fohrenkamm at star three, this court wrote, when the state provides no evidence to satisfy its burden to prove that evidence was obtained in compliance with the United States and Minnesota Constitution, as is the case here, it fails to meet its burden by a preponderance of the evidence. That's what
And
happened here.
so, can you tell me what is the best case? Because I'm seeing like allusion to sort of different errors. Because as you said, which is how I might read the record, is both defense counsel and the court, I think you use the word and it seems apt, acquiesced in the state's perspective in terms of the hearing. What is the case that tells us that is there an error in there that would preclude a remand? Or what case bet most precludes a remand?
Sure. I mean, I think if you look at page six of our reply brief, Your Honor, there's a couple of non-precedential cases cited and a precedential one called Farah. And in Farah, the same thing happened, at least in terms of the state was on notice as to what the defendant's claim was. So, for example, this is not a case where the defendant's claim changed after the hearing. That's Needham. And in Needham, the Supreme Court said, well, the defendant's claim change. We have to give the state an opportunity to present its case given the defendant's claim changed. In Farah, this court declined to remand for a new suppression hearing because the state knew the defendant's arguments and had the opportunity to call witnesses to address them. If the parties had agreed, had walked into that hearing, that first hearing, and said, you know what, we're for a lot of reasons, we're going to do it this way. We're going to have the probate. We're going to have the defendant and then the probation officer testify. I think that's error under Rasmussen, but maybe that's a different question. I don't know. But as you said, Judge Smith, this was all the prosecutor. At page three, he says, quote, I'll require, I, me, I'll require the defendant to meet his burden. The defense counsel at page four says he was not, quote, aware this issue was going to be brought up. And then most importantly, at the end of that hearing, as you said, Your Honor, the officer who performed the traffic stop, he's there. He's at that hearing. And the judge at page 26 asked the prosecutor, do you want to call him today? So the judge is not on board with this idea that, oh, we're only doing standing. The judge asks.
What about
And
day
the
two?
officer is there and the prosecutor refuses.
What about day two? Was the officer, does the record tell us if the officer was there on the second day?
I doubt it. The record doesn't tell us one way or the other.
Okay.
But I don't think it matters. The point is, the government, you have to look, you don't look at this in a vacuum. You have to look at it through the lens of one party in this hearing has a burden to prove that the evidence was lawfully obtained. That party had the opportunity to call any witness it wanted to try to meet its burden. It chose to litigate this case on a theory, not only on a theory that has absolutely no support in the law, none, zero, runs contrary to the United States Supreme Court, runs contrary to every federal appellate court decision I could find. This idea that you can't contest your own seizure, chose to do that and chose to, basically browbeat everyone into making the defendant go first and then leaving everything else aside and saying, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything. That's on the government. And there's no need to be quote unquote fair to the district court judge. First of all, the district court judge is not a party here. So the idea that we have to be fair to the district court judge, I'm going to push back on a little bit. Number two, the district court judge at any point here could have and should have said, what are we doing? Why is the defendant going first? Instead, the district court judge thoroughly and intentionally adopted everything Mr. Buehler said, every legal analysis, every factual assertion. And so that's the district court's ruling that's in front of you. And there's no need to give anyone a second chance to prove something for a case that has already been pending for more than 2 years, for which Mr. Peters will serve his entire sentence before it's resolved. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Buehler for the state.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Buehler. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this criminal appeal. At the outset, I just want to thank the court for accommodating me by allowing me to appear via Zoom, given my current physical limitations. I also want to apologize to this court, and as preparing for my oral argument, I noticed several typographical errors in my appellate brief that just are inexcusable. So the main issue before this court, at least based upon counsel's argument, is this issue with regard to Fourth Amendment standing. You know, in my brief, I quoted from Rakes, I quoted from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Sorenson that says the initial inquiry at every search and seizure analysis is whether the defendant has standing to object to the search or seizure. And I just would point out that more recently, the Minnesota Supreme Court in State versus Edstrom, 916 Northwest 2nd 512 at page 517, this is a quote from the Supreme Court. The state bears the burden of establishing that the challenge evidence was obtained in accordance with the Constitution, citing Rasmussen, which counsel hangs his hat on. It goes on to say, a defendant, however, bears the threshold burden of proving that he or she has a right protected by the Constitution, citing State versus Gale, the opinion that I quoted from in my memorandum and is cited repeatedly in the brief to this court. More importantly, I go back to this court's own, it's granted, it's an unpublished opinion. It's not precedential. This court doesn't have to follow it. But I think State versus Lunday is an opinion that I think summarizes my position in this case, where this court said the defendant bears the burden of proving standing or a reasonable expectation of privacy before the state would be required to show through the testimony of police officers the legality of police conduct. He failed to do so, and the court was not required to hear testimony concerning police conduct. That's the position that I took in this case.
Which case is that?
State versus Lunday, Your Honor, Lunday, decided
that's
by...
That's in your brief?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
So what case is there that provides, I mean, I understand the different, the arguments you're making, at least with respect, you know, well, the argument you are making, you know, with respect to a lack of, and we'll use the word standing for it, but what authority is there for the proposition that the state does not need to go forward on the issues relative to this a stop until a district court has ruled on a person standing?
Well, first of all, I just would note, Your Honor, there was no stop in this case. That was never even alleged.
We'll say seizure. Seizure,
correct.
Then.
Correct. It was alleged in the motion that there was a seizure that occurred after the defendant had voluntarily stopped his motor vehicle. I'm not aware of any case that says a district court has to do this. I'm also not aware of any decision that says a court can't do this. And I go back to, again, cases such as Gale and Edstrom, where the court said a defendant bears the threshold burden of proving, not alleging. If all the defendant had to do is allege that there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, then obviously the state would have the burden of going forward at every suppression hearing. Now, that's what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in Rasmussen back in 1965, but of course, that was long before the rules of criminal procedure were enacted by the Supreme Court. And it is interesting to note that If you look at Rasmussen, the Minnesota Supreme Court specifically incorporated the notice requirement in Rule 701 from Rasmussen. It incorporated the waiver issue in Rule 1001 Subdivision 2, and it set forth the omnibus hearing in Rules 1101 to 1104. But the only thing the Minnesota Supreme Court said is that the court may receive evidence offered by the prosecutor or defendant on any omnibus issue. Never indicated in the rules from procedure that in every single case that an allegation made by the defendant imposes the burden on the prosecution to go forward. Now, granted, I would say in the vast majority of cases, that's the case, but that's typically, this isn't your typical case. First, I was disputing whether or not a search or in this case, a seizure had occurred, but more importantly, even if one did occur, did this defendant have a reasonable expectation of privacy, given the fact that he was on probation in the state of North Dakota for two felonies, which means he had a significantly reduced expectation of privacy to begin with, but then came to Minnesota in direct violation of the district court's order in North Dakota.
What case can you tell us? I mean, the only thing that was challenged in the appellant's omnibus motion is whether there is reasonable articulable suspicion for the seizure. And then I understand that, you know, at the omnibus hearing, the state raised an argument, I think, for the, as I can see it for the first time, about standing. What case can you point us to that doesn't deal with a search, it just deals with a seizure?
The best
that puts into play someone's expectation of privacy to be, I'm not sure where, in the state, or I'm not sure what that means exactly.
Well, the best case that I can cite to, Your Honor, would be State versus Roy, the Second Circuit opinion that I cited to, because in that case, it was a defendant who objected to the stop of his motor vehicle as well as the search. Second Circuit never even addressed either issue because it found that the defendant, as a prison escapee, was a trespasser on society. More importantly, I think this court in State versus Stevenson, which technically involved a search, but the only evidence in that case was the seizure of the defendant, that is his arrest in his own home. This case, in my view, is just simply a natural extension of Stevenson. That is that a court order can deprive a defendant of a reasonable expectation of privacy. And in Stevenson, it was another otherwise law-abiding citizen who was in his own home. And it was found that the order for protection issued against him deprived him of any expectation of privacy in his home. In fact, I think this court went so far as to say that it is simply nonsense to say that society is prepared to recognize his right to be where society, by the process of the law, has ordered him not to be. That's the argument that I was making. Now, granted, Stevenson's a little different.
Is your argument that someone in the appellant's status situation that you've alleged with respect to violating a probationary rule, I think, I'm not to leave the state without written permission, that person can be, what would happen if that person were just seized on the street and, you know, pat searched and they found, and there was something found? That person has no constitutional right to a search supported by reasonable articulable suspicion? Is
that
right?
That would be my argument, because part and parcel of the defendant's burden is proving that he has a protectable right under the Fourth Amendment or Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution. That's his burden. And given
would that be true also if he were, you know, arrested without probable cause and then searched incident to arrest?
I would argue that yes, under United States versus Roy, that the defendant cannot prove that threshold burden of a reasonable expectation of privacy, where he, when he is found, where he is specifically ordered by a court not to go. And this was a court order issued in North Dakota, which was valid. The defendant and his probation agent both acknowledged it. It was actually signed by the defendant. So he clearly was on notice that he could not come to the state of Minnesota without written permission of his probation agent, which was conceded. And his agent never gave him written permission. I conceded below that the defendant had a subjective expectation of privacy and that there was this informal policy in North Dakota. But I was trying to force the issue on, is this objectively reasonable, as this court found it wasn't in Stevenson. So my view is, going back to this Rasmussen and the court's interpretation since then, is that this really, this argument that the counsel has, that I browbeat the district court and the defense counsel into litigating this issue, I simply was standing upon what the Supreme Court has said, the Minnesota Supreme Court anyway, and the U.S. Supreme Court, that's the defendant's initial burden to go forward. It's a threshold burden.
So is it your position that if the state has an argument about, and we'll call it standing, that the state could just come to the omnibus hearing than without witnesses and just demand, just wait until the appellant put, or the defendant, excuse me, puts on some testimony.
Yes, at least, though, at least in the case where I believe that I've got a legitimate argument for it. I mean, if there's clearly a stop, you know, where a search has occurred, a seizure has occurred, hey, all the defendant's got to do is take the stand and say, hey, they stopped my car. They turned on the lights. They arrested me. They pat searched me. He's met his burden. It's going to shift to me. I had my officer there because I wasn't sure how the court was going to go forward on the standing issue. And counsel seems to take issue with the fact that I bring this issue up. What was I supposed to do? Put in my exhibits, sandbag defense counsel, write a written brief to the court and have the district court rule on it without giving the defense a chance to respond to it. Now, under State versus Vang, an unpublished opinion from this court, the district court can sua sponte raise standing. And if the defendant hasn't met his burden to cite it, I thought I was being upfront with both the district court and defense counsel by raising this issue. And it was clear defense counsel acknowledged that once I had put those exhibits in and he had a chance to talk to his client, that he had a burden here. He initially put his client on the stand in order to try to meet that burden. And when I cross-examined the defendant and he pointed out the fact that, yes, he did not have written permission from his attorney, the hearing was continued at defense counsel's request so that he could call the probation agent. And as you pointed out, at the outset of that hearing, defense counsel made it clear that it was his understanding the only issue that was being litigated was whether he had met that threshold or initial burden to establish standing. And that was the only issue that we were addressing on that day. That was defense counsel who said that. That was certainly my understanding, and I believe that certainly was the district court's understanding once that came about. To argue that now we should be stuck with the record as it is, even though defense counsel agreed to proceed in that fashion, isn't giving the prosecution a second bite of the apple. This is not a case where I lost before the district court, which are all the cases cited by defense counsel in this court's refusal to remand, are cases where the prosecution lost and now was seeking a second bite. The simple fact is we never addressed the merits, that is whether a seizure had actually occurred in this case, because defense counsel, myself, the district court were all under the impression we were litigating simply that initial or threshold issue, you know, shorthand saying of standing. That is, did the defendant have a reasonable expectation of privacy when he was in the state of Minnesota in direct violation of a court order? That's the theory we all proceeded on. And to say that the district court should be deprived of the opportunity, or even the prosecution be deprived of the opportunity, I think is unfair. And I don't understand how you can reconcile it with cases like State versus Licari, where the Minnesota Supreme Court remanded for hearing. It was the prosecution who won to the district court, lost on appeal, but the Supreme Court said, hey, there's an alternative theory here. We're going to remand back to the district court on the inevitable discovery argument. Here, we would just be remanding to address the merits of the Fourth Amendment issue. That is, did a seizure actually occur? And I'll be clear. My position is that it is the defendant who bears the burden of establishing, at least putting some evidence in the record, that a seizure occurred. I don't know how you can conclude otherwise when the Supreme Court says, again, the defendant bears the threshold burden of proving that he or she has a right protected by the Constitution. Simply alleging that it's filing a motion is not proving anything. And I think the law is pretty clear that motions are not evidence. And so that this is not just a burden of pleading, this is actually a burden of production. It requires the defendant to go forward to establish some evidence that his rights were violated under either the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution or Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution.
So in any case where there's a defendant who is saying that they were unlawfully seized, they have a burden to call witnesses first to show that they were seized?
I certainly believe that that's the way you can interpret that language, but let's be honest. As a prosecutor, if I know that, in fact, an officer has turned the lights on in the squad car, has frisked the defendant, has searched the defendant, I'm not going to raise that issue because it would be frivolous, because the evidence is absolutely clear that a search or seizure occurred. I'd be wasting the court's time. I'd be wasting my time. I'm not going to put the defendant through that additional hurdle. This is not that type of case. There was no stop in this case. The issue was whether there was a seizure that occurred when the officer approached an already parked motor vehicle that the defendant was sitting in.
I guess I've just seen many cases where there is a legitimate question about when a seizure occurred. And I guess your position is that the defendant has to prove something first.
And that's my position, but let's be honest, Your Honor, the facts of this case are highly unusual. And that what's more intriguing, in my opinion, is the fact that we have a defendant who is on probation for two felony convictions, is in this state in direct violation of a court order. That's why I focused the bulk of my argument on did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy, which is part and parcel of whether a search or a seizure that he has a protectable interest in occurred. That's the reason that I argued the case the way I did, the reason I put the initial exhibits in, why I put counsel on notices to the argument that I was making, because this was a highly unusual fact scenario that I believe is one that is a direct extension of this court's decision in Stevenson and consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Rakes and several Minnesota Supreme Court opinions that I'd cited in my brief. That's the reason it was argued the way it was, but for counsel to claim that I browbeat the district court and defense counsel by bringing up this issue is flat out inconsistent with the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Edstrom, Gale, that whole line of cases that places the burden on the defendant.
Mr. Buehler, why do you focus on the question whether a seizure occurred? Because isn't it clear that he, at some point in time, he was seized? It's just a matter of when. Correct? That's the issue.
Correct, Your Honor. But the way the issue was phrased in the motion was it was the officer's approach to the motor vehicle was the only seizure that he was contesting. And that's the reason that I brought that up. But if the defendant lacked a reasonable expectation of privacy, that becomes moot, in my opinion.
So the threshold fact that you so what I mean, what exactly does the defendant what evidence does the defendant need in that kind of a case to meet the threshold burden that you are focusing on?
See, I'm about ready to run out of time. If you'll just give me a little bit more time to explain.
Please.
If this was not a case involving a defendant who I claimed had no expectation of privacy, that is, that he wasn't on probation, he wasn't in violation of court order, if it was just a typical, say, police citizen encounter on the street, the defendant takes the stand and testifies, hey, he was in uniform, he pulled a gun, he commanded me not to stop, he pat searched me, he did something, he put something in issue. But again, if those had occurred, I typically would not have contested a defendant standing to object or that a seizure had not occurred because, like I said, I'd be wasting everybody's time by arguing something that's obvious. That wasn't the case here.
Well, I was going to ask whether it's either customary in your county or whether it ever happens that the defendant takes the stand first to give testimony such as that and then steps down, the prosecutor puts in its evidence, and then the defendant comes back for its rebuttal case. I mean, is that the way it's done ever?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I'm not gonna say customary, but yes, I've had several cases in the 30 plus years I've been a prosecutor where I've argued that no seizure occurred and that it imposed that initial burden on the defense. And I've had district courts agree and require the defense to put on evidence. Then I call an officer to rebut it if I deem fit. That's highly unusual though, because those fact scenarios are very narrow, but they're in this case is even more unusual considering the reasonable expectation of privacy issue. I definitely see that I'm out of time. If there are any other questions, if not, I just want to thank you for allowing me to appear by Zoom today.
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Buehler. Mr. Butler.
Thank you. Happy to answer any questions, but I did want to clarify a couple things about the record. As to whether there was a stop or a seizure, you can use whatever word you want. It doesn't matter. But at the trial transcript, page 258 and page 264, Mr. Buehler himself used the phrase traffic stop to describe what happened here. At page 265, Mr. Buehler asked the officer why he, quote, stopped, end quote. Mr. Peters and the officer explained why. This was, of course, a traffic stop. State versus the continuing
But
validity of
it's true
Rasmussen.
that that record's not available for us to review whether that's.
It's not available, Your Honor, because the state chose not to put that officer on the witness stand when invited to do so by the district court. Yes, that is
Thank
true.
you.
That's the hole in the record is held against the party with the burden, and the party with the burden is the government. The continuing validity of Rasmussen, you can look to State versus Pauley, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2022, which reputedly cites Rasmussen as the way to handle suppression hearings, including in situations, as in Pauley, where the defendant bears some burden. Pauley is a case about the private search doctrine. And in Pauley, the Minnesota Supreme Court made clear that that at some part, there are multiple steps of the situation for private searches, but at some point there, the defendant bears the burden to prove something. But Rasmussen still controls the procedure by which that is handled.
Mr. Butler, does the defendant bear the burden of proving that a search or that a seizure occurred?
No, definitely not, Your Honor. The only thing a defendant bears a burden of persuasion on is to show in a search case that the defendant has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place searched. The question of whether there has been a seizure or a search at all is part of the government's argument for why the defendant's rights may not have been violated. If there's no seizure, if a person would have been free to walk away, would have felt free to walk away from the encounter with law enforcement, then there's no seizure, then there's no Fourth Amendment violation. That's fine. That's the government's obligation to show that didn't happen. I have never in 22 years of doing this job seen a case to Judge Johnson's question where the defendant is forced to testify first. And if that's happened in Polk County, I find it highly disturbing. The law on the structure of these hearings is extremely clear. And if Mr. Buehler wants to ask the Minnesota Supreme Court to overrule State versus Needham, which says exactly what the defendant has to do, or State versus Rasmussen, which has been in place for, you know, time immemorial, he's certainly free to do so. On the remand question, I heard respondents say that all of the cases cited in our brief involved situations where the state lost at the district court. That is also not true. A case called State versus Mueller, cited at page 6, is a decision from this court where the state won at the district court level. The defendant appealed. This court reversed because the state didn't carry its burden at the district court to prove that the evidence had lawfully been obtained, and this court rejected the state's request to remand to give it another shot because, as here, the state in Mueller was on notice of what the defendant's arguments were and called whatever witnesses it saw fit to call as the party with the burden to try to undercut those arguments, and they don't get a second chance to do so, whether they won or lost below. Finally, on this reasonable expectation of privacy thing, all the cases the state cited, including Roy, this old Second Circuit case, Roy involves the search of a car. The primary thing at issue there is the search of a car. Roy is also, first of all, Mr. Peters is not an escapee from a prison. He's a guy who's maybe in violation of a different state's probation condition. No Minnesota judge said he did anything wrong. In Roy, there are three judges on the panel. Two of them say this trespasser on society thing. The third concurs and says, I don't understand what we're doing here and what those other two are about. That rationale has, as far as I can tell, never been adopted by anyone ever since. And so it's not certainly not binding and not particularly persuasive. Edstrom is a search case, so of course, reasonable expectation of privacy comes into play. And the unpublished case Mr. Buehler mentioned, first of all, is from about 30 years ago. It's 1997. Second, it is, of course, a search case. This is a seizure case. My client had the right to challenge the constitutionality of his own seizure. The district court erred in concluding otherwise, and we ask you to reverse his conviction.
Judge Smith, may I ask one or two more Please. Questions? With respect to Edstrom, I'm not sure if you have it in front of you, if you remember the language, but the sentence Mr. Buehler is focusing on says a defendant, however, bears the threshold burden of proving that he or she has a right protected by the Constitution. I guess I'm not sure if I could you please summarize your position about or your interpretation of Edstrom and how you urge us to interpret it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think there's two lines of thought there. The procedural issue of how all that is done is controlled by Rasmussen. State proceeds first at the omnibus hearing, explains what happened. If the defense has witnesses to call, they call witnesses to explain the reasonable expectation of privacy. The word threshold in that sentence is a little sloppy, but it might sort of relate to the order in which the district court might decide the legal issues. Because it's true that if the defendant doesn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place searched, it doesn't matter how otherwise unconstitutional the government's conduct was, because it didn't violate that defendant's personal rights. So a district court could say, well, you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy. That's the first thing I'm doing. That's threshold. And therefore, I'm not getting to the second part. But Byrd versus the United States, a case from the U.S. Supreme Court, makes clear that Fourth Amendment standing is not like Article III standing. Article III standing has to be addressed in federal court, has to be addressed before you get to the quote-unquote merits of an issue. Because if you don't have Article III standing, you shouldn't even be here. Byrd rejects that from the Fourth Amendment context. So it's just all part of the quote merits question.
Thank you. One more question is, in your brief, you argued four issues. We've been focused on the first, suppression. What if the court were to grant you relief on that first argument? Is it necessary and appropriate for the court to consider your second, third, and fourth arguments? And are you asking us to proceed to consider all three of them?
Answer to your first question is no. No, I think the answer is no to both questions. If the court holds that this seizure was unconstitutional and reverses Mr. Peters' conviction, that's it. That convictions, excuse me, because there are two. That is the only thing this court needs to decide. It does not need to address the other issues.
Well, ordinarily, we don't reverse outright when we find an error in a suppression ruling. We ordinarily, unless there's a stipulated evidence trial under subdivision four, but ordinarily we reverse and remand for further proceedings. And if there is an error, we've also discussed, it seems there's been some discussion during argument about the possibility of a more limited remand, not finding error so much in the conclusion, but remanding for additional proceedings on the suppression motion. But so with that understanding, could I ask the question again? And
Sure. Let me take the second thing first. If the court chooses to remand this case to give the state another chance to approve the constitutionality of the seizure, then yes, I do think the court needs to address all of the other issues, because issue two is a sufficiency claim that would make that if we're right about, makes the drug conviction go away no matter what. Issue three would result in a new trial, even if the district court finds that the conviction, evidence was lawfully obtained. Maybe issue four you don't need to get to if you would give him a new trial or reverse on sufficiency grounds on the drug conviction, issue four being the sentence. So if you remand it, then you do have to address the other issues. If you reverse, you're right, Your Honor, that if you reverse on if you reverse and say all the evidence recovered in this case has to be suppressed, I think technically you would remand it. I'd be okay with you not addressing the other issues, because without that evidence, there's nothing else to do. There's no drugs, and there's no evidence to support the DUI count. So presumably on remand, the charges would be dismissed. If the court did want to address the other issues, you'd have to do that.
Yeah, that might be practically true in this case, but otherwise you would want the sufficiency.
Yeah, addressed. I think the sufficiency should probably be addressed. I mean, if nothing else, if the evidence is insufficient, then the drugs go away altogether. I will say that, of course, we think the evidence is insufficient to support knowing possession. And if you agree with us, you still need to address the search and seizure issue, because it does affect the DWI conviction and sentence.
Thank you.
Okay. Looks like that's it for questions from the panel. Thank you both very much for your briefing, your oral arguments. The case is submitted and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honors.